I want to talk about a conundrum as old as the hills, a dilemma I suppose experienced most sharply in public life, but definitely not exclusively, because it's part of everyone's life. It's the experience of having ideals which we simply cannot make happen. It's when the irresistible force of idealism hits the immovable rocks of reality and has to be compromised. It's the experience, if you like, of thwarted visionaries, when the eye sees further than the hand can reach. It's an experience, I suspect, which matters to many of us, niggles, haunts, even though we may think we've become hardened realists over the years who can simply shrug our shoulders and say, that's just the way life is, these compromises. It matters because moral ideals are too deeply embedded in our human identity simply to shrug off. Now, whether you attribute this power of moral idealism within us to the spirit of God or just to socio-biological factors, I will say more about that next week. But either way, we have them. They're here within us, these ideals, and they matter to us. And I believe this is true of more public figures than skeptics might think. I remember when I was a mildly revolting student in the 1970s, how skeptically I viewed, for example, someone like Henry Kissinger, former US Secretary of State. He epitomized to me then a fairly soulless realism and pragmatism. But his recent memoir, World Order, tells a very different story. There, as another former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has said, the famous realist sounds surprisingly idealistic throughout. Kissinger was constantly bringing moral principles to bear on his calculations about power, and it consistently mattered to him to do so, whatever you think of the outcome for the moment. So it's a widespread dilemma. It matters to us, and it's not going to go away, is it? Ideals will always matter because they cannot be shrugged off without losing our soul. Compromise will always be inevitable because, as I shall argue, it's the very nature and structure of reality which frustrates our ideals, not just our own moral failings. What I therefore want to do in all these lectures is not to pretend that we can ever avoid compromise, we can't avoid the dilemma, nor incidentally am I going to try to offer specific criteria for distinguishing between good and bad compromise. That's an interesting and useful thing to do, but there are a lot of ethical handbooks about it. We might come back to it in discussion. But what I do want to do is to explore the underlying implications of the very fact of the dilemma. Why is it inevitable? What does this persistence of compromised ideals mean about the ultimate nature of reality, the world, and ourselves? And what, therefore, does that mean about the sort of persons we will need to be to operate realistically within such a world without becoming cynical? To try to answer these questions, I'll be drawing on some analysis from philosophy, some from theology, and a little from literature too. But let me first begin with some concrete experiences, not those analyses. Some specific examples of thwarted idealism, just to help show the range of issues which the dilemma can raise. First, an experience from the First World War, specifically the experience of that celebrated but fleeting Christmas truce of 1914, when the opposing sides stopped firing, some played football with each other, and exchanged presents. A moment which has generated all sorts of reactions, but among them, quite notably, this one from someone called Henry Williamson, a soldier who became quite a well-known poet and novelist. When I saw the morning star rising in the east over that broken and frosted landscape, he wrote, suitably poetically. When I heard the singing of carols where but a few hours before shells were whining, machine gun bullets cutting flesh and bone. When I saw friendliness and benevolence on the battlefield, a great hope arose within me that forever the power and blessing of peace would spread, people would realize that in disputes between peoples, both may be in the right. Now, what's notable about that, seems to me, is the sheer scale of that sort of idealism. A belief that all people are fundamentally peaceful, rational, and would always or could always come to agree. And actually, if you read the backstory of Williamson, it becomes even clearer, the colossal scale of his idealism. For in fact, he believed that even Hitler himself might have absorbed that spirit of the football match when he, Hitler, was in the trenches, as he was. So later in the 1930s, Williamson simply did not think there could be another war. And incredibly, he held to this ideal, not only through the Somme and Passchendaele and through the Second World War, but right through to the Vietnam War, when he was still arguing for peace. All those events palpably discredited his belief, yet he held to it. An extraordinary testimony to the sheer power of idealism to persist, but also surely an example of one of the key issues of the dilemma, namely how some idealism can only persist by hardening into a kind of immature fantasy, by skewing reality to fit the ideals, in this case, even to the extent of imagining Hitler to be a potential saviour. Few read Williamson today. You don't get much oxygen of publicity for views like that. But it is, it seems to me, an example of a cast of mind which we can always meet. I think it was Dennis Healy who said of Tony Benn and his idealism that as Benn got older, instead of maturing, he immatured. Different context, different politics, controversial statement, but perhaps a similar mindset being revealed there. And that raises the issue, an issue of how we can be idealistic without, so to speak, hardening into fantasy, which I shall certainly need to return to. The second example, another kind of experience, in some way addresses this, but raises another question, another issue, which we'll need to pursue. And I'm thinking now not of a poet of the maverick right in the war, but a liberal left political philosopher in peacetime, Bernard Williams. Again, certainly another idealist. In his case, socialism was a clear ideal. Socialism, he wrote, just to give you a flavour, is real egalitarian politics. It is real egalitarian politics in civil rights, healthcare, and education, the only good systematic political thought we have. And overall, Williams persisted with that kind of idealism, even when those ideals were compromised by events, as indeed they were. But the difference is that when they were thwarted, he didn't fantasize. What he did was to modify his ideals, to reshape them, to accommodate them. I now quote from a little bit of later writing, the most optimistic kinds of socialism, he wrote later, must adapt to other forms. Because, I quote again, in fact, human values just cannot all be rendered compatible. Just cannot all be rendered compatible. Why the difference? Well, the context lying behind the reaction was very different to Williamson's, not war but politics. The academic Williams had in fact tried to move from academia to public service to try out his ideals in practical policy. So this really was the context of politics. What happened was that he made that move into public life at almost the exact time that Margaret Thatcher's government came to power, when the 60s and 70s changed to the 80s, which was hardly a propitious time for any kind of socialist agenda, obviously. But it wasn't just the different context of politics and that particular government, that particular rock of reality he came up against. It was first, I think, the fact that Williams was trying to act out his theories, to enact them, to make them happen in real public policy. That's what caused him to adapt. And second, I suspect, the difference in his reaction was, once again, that he simply had a different cast of mind. When he came up against the hard political facts of a change government, he did not see this just as a contingent fact which happened to make his ideals impossible in practice at that time. He looked beneath those particular contingencies, and he seemed to see something about the nature of reality itself, which makes human values incompatible in principle sometimes, not just in practice. Human values just cannot be rendered compatible, not all of them. That was his quote. It's a view incidentally shared by his fellow political philosopher Isaiah Berlin at much the same time, and interestingly hinted at by Kissinger too in his book. And so this is the further issue raised by this particular example. What happens when ideals seem impossible to fulfill completely in principle, not just in particular circumstances? And what does that mean? For Williams, what happened was that he eventually, in a sense, retreated back into academia more to ponder it. But is that the only reaction possible? Again, it's an issue I want to return to today and in the next lectures. And it leads me to the third example, where again there's another kind of response, but again raises yet another issue to be dealt with. It's a different context again. This is small town Texas I'm in now, and the experience underlying it is a private domestic incident. It's not related to public life or a public event. But I think it's a telling example because of what it led to. The experience was simply that of a young man called Stanley Hauerwas, who'd returned home from Yale, from university, to discover his father had been, all through that term, had been building him a rifle. Hauerwas's father, I quote from a biography, had been meticulously carving the stock and boring the barrel, beautifully made as only a craftsman could do. Clearly, a real act of love for his son. The young Hauerwas, however, fresh from university, had acquired new ideals. And these compelled him, first of all, simply to reject it outright, rather brutally, I have to say. In the future, he says, I quote, he said to his father, "A wise social policy would mean that someday we are going to have to take these goddamn things away from you people." I wish I could do that in a southern accent. But in the very same breath, his biographer tells us, his ideals also made him realize, I quote again, he still hadn't done the right thing in saying that. So at one level, a familiar scenario, a bright young person caught in transition between traditional small-town conservative upbringing and new values gained elsewhere. First, shooting metaphorically from the hip, and then realizing that life is not so simple after all. And illustrating, I suppose, just another example of Williams' perception that sometimes one set of ideals just cannot be compatible with another set. In principle, in this case, ideals of pacifism sometimes conflicting with ideals or values of personal relationship, like grace and gratitude within a family. But there's something else going on here too. It's not just another example of the incompatibility of values. What's going on may or may not have been true for Williams as well, but here it is explicit. It was the acute sense that neither set of values could be jettisoned without regret. He realized he still had not done the right thing. So acutely felt that, in fact, that sense of regret became a catalyst for Havas for a lifetime's work, an effort as an ethicist, to find a way for both sets of values to coexist. How can this be done? It turns out he thinks they can always be held together in our character, even if not in our actions. And that, too, is an issue I'll want to return to. So, a poet who kept his ideals but denied reality with a fantasy, a political philosopher who adapted his ideals but in the end withdrew from public life, and an ethicist trying to hold them together. Three examples of how this common experience of thwarted idealism can play out in different contexts with different kinds of people, different castes of mind. And raising these issues, which I think can only be dealt with, in one sense, as I've said, by asking some of the underlying questions. Why is it that ideals do seem to be incompatible and have to get compromised? What does it mean about the nature of reality itself and ourselves? And so to help me pursue these sorts of questions, what I'm now going to do is turn first to a philosopher and then perhaps to a bit of theology. You will see, I should have said at the beginning on your sheets, if you can see them in this dim ecclesiastical light, roughly where I'm going. If you can't see them, you're not missing anything vital except how near I am to the end, which might be an encouragement or not to you as we go on. The philosopher is Karl Jaspers, a 20th century German philosopher who had encountered this dilemma of compromise in his own experience quite a lot, especially in the Second World War, when he lived in constant fear himself because of his Jewish connections, and later when he was working closely with people who were dealing with their guilt or their sense of guilt in the aftermath of war. And Jaspers first tried to use his background in law, in medicine and psychiatry, he was qualified in all three, to get a purchase on the dilemma, to get behind it. But he felt it wasn't enough, and that's when he turned to philosophy, and in fact to the literary genre, in particular, of tragedy. Because that's where, from Greek drama to Shakespeare, he found this experience of compromised idealism most searingly portrayed in tragedy. And it's where he found the tools, he thought, to get beyond it, where he found in the title of his essay, "Tragedy is not enough." So first, his analysis of the dilemma, and then his venture beyond. In his analysis, he identified three reasons for the dilemma, all of them rooted in the fundamental structure of ourselves and the world. The first is that we're naturally actors in life. We do things. We're not just observers. And it's when we act to make things happen that our limits become apparent. In terms of Williamson's wartime metaphor, it's only when you actually try to keep playing a game of friendly football in the middle of an artillery barrage that you know you cannot. It's also in action that we discover these limits are actually inevitable, not just to do with a personal weakness of will or a lack of imagination. They're a consequence of our finitude, our limited reach in the world, a world structured by time and space. So just to stay with the metaphor very simply for the moment, oversimply, even if we were morally perfect and hugely imaginative. None of us could ever even have reached all the generals and all the politicians to stop that war, let alone persuade them. This world, shaped as it is by this complex interrelation of space and time, is just too dense to be fully penetrated by any finite agent, actor, you or me, when we try to implement any ideal. Which is, of course, exactly what Bernard Williams was finding out. It was when he tried to implement socialist ideals in practice that he found he was thwarted. He described finding a world, I quote now Williams, just too densely occupied to yield to his principles. And his criticism, for those who are interested in the academic debate here, his criticism of political philosophers like Robert Nozick and John Rawls was precisely that they failed to see the intrinsic complexity of reality because they'd never really tested their theories by action. Or to take other examples, only when the international community tried through the United Nations to act, not just talk, to secure peace in the Congo in 1960, did it realize the sheer density of issues involved there. Only when, on the whole, we tried to act in the Middle East, do all the layers of complexity really begin to emerge, brought to the surface. Yet, we are all naturally agents. We try to make things happen. It's what we are. It's who we are. We're not just commentators or contemplatives. Hence the dilemma. That's the first reason Jaspers identified. A second reason for this inevitable frustration lies in the fact we're not just agents either, not just actors. We are actually also idea makers and contemplatives. We have a capacity to extrapolate from particular things, people, situations, and create general ideas about them. And this too sets up inevitable conflicts and compromise. That's because no general ideas we form can ever perfectly match all the particular instances which underlie them. Particulars, by definition, have unique elements about them which cannot be generalized. For example, if we think, as we do, of course, quite often, our particular child has been unjustly treated at school, yes, we'll necessarily have drawn on a general idea of what justice is, derived from the way others are treated, but we'll also be seeing unique elements in our child's particular situation which just don't match that general principle, which we think make our child an exception. And so inevitably, there will be a need to compromise between the particular and the general. That was exactly our ethicist's dilemma, wasn't it? What was generally right in his view about guns and their ownership conflicted with what seemed right about the particular issue of accepting ownership of this particular gun in these particular circumstances of his family and his relationships. And the trouble is, we can't just give up having general ideas any more than we can give up being agents, because general ideas are what free us sometimes from the prison of just being in the present moment in the particular. They enable us to think, act more widely. They're necessary, general ideas, for all good science, social organization, and even art. So it's another reason why the dilemma is inevitable. Our very way of thinking has to be structured in this kind of world as both universal and particular, and so the conflicts inevitably arise. The third reason, it's inevitable simply because we're always in a changing world, always in a state of organic transition. And transition, in Jaspers' words, is a natural zone of tragedy. After all, any organically changing world, as distinct from a world which changes by instant and wholesale revolution, has to deal with the new alongside continuing aspects of the old order. Rightly so. Organic developments, by definition, work with the best of the old and do not wholly displace the old. But this does then bring conflict between the old and new. And Hauerwas's dilemma example provides the example again, doesn't it? The young man was, of course, in transition between his new world of Christian social ethics, as he saw them, and his traditional family values. Yes, his new ideas mattered, but he could still see the old values also contain something good. So again, some form of compromise will be inevitable. And it isn't just a passing problem, some temporary friction in some necessary process towards a great Hegelian resolution when all is one. As long as we are in time, we'll always be in this sort of organic process of change, where the old and new run together. So on all counts, the dilemma of compromise is inevitable. It will always arise because we have to both act and think within complex structures of time and change. And it's these deep structures of reality, not just our weakness of will, our sin, our moral failings. It's these deep structures of reality which do not always allow ideal outcomes without compromise. And as Jaspers points out, the double bind, just to make you feel even more depressed in case you're not already, about this inevitability, is that as reflective people, we can see this inevitability, really. And that can make matters worse by paralyzing us. Rather like Hamlet, who Jaspers judges to be paralyzed, not so much by some culpable weakness of character, but more by his clear vision. Hamlet has simply seen the impossibilities of life too clearly. So what's the point of trying? And it's another aspect of the dilemma. So there's the analysis, which I suppose could, as I say, leave us rather depressed, or at least more robustly, just having to accept this is the way it is, values will collide, idealism will be frustrated, life is bound to be tragic. But Carl Jaspers doesn't leave it there, and nor do I. As I said, he also felt compelled to go beyond tragedy. And that is precisely because it is a dilemma. He felt it still as a dilemma. It isn't resolved by proving it or showing it to be so inevitable. He could not shrug it off by demonstrating its inevitability. This fact that idealism persists, or at least the regret when we cannot achieve it, persists in such a deep level, even though so often thwarted, that persistence becomes even more remarkable, precisely when we see how inevitable it is. And Jaspers saw this persistence, interestingly, at work, especially in the phenomenon which may well resonate with many of you, the phenomenon of what he called guiltless guilt, feeling guilty about these compromises, even though we see they are inevitable. Even though we see they are inevitable, still feeling guilty about them. Something Jaspers noted in spades because of his own background as a psychiatrist, and especially this practical concern he had for post-war guilt, which I mentioned in Germany. And so he pursued this sense of guiltless guilt, not simply to find a practical therapy for it, though that will be a very good thing to do, I hasten to add, but rather to see what it implied. Why this persistence of idealism, evidenced by this sense of guiltless guilt? Where is it pointing? It can't be pointing to actual guilt, as if we really could reach as far as our eyes see, but don't try hard enough. The whole point is we can't. So could it be that this deep unease, which feels like guilt but is not, suggests there's actually something more to reality altogether, something beyond tragedy after all, even though we can't currently reach it? And for Jaspers, and for me, that's just what it does imply. This fact that so many of us cannot simply shrug our shoulders when the eye keeps seeing further than the hands can reach does indeed point to something radically more about the nature of reality than we've so far uncovered. And it's because the force of the cannot in that sentence, we cannot just shrug our shoulders, doesn't seem to be just psychological, something to be dealt with just by therapy or cultivating a more robust temperament. It's a more fundamental philosophical cannot, a sense that reality itself cannot be exhausted by these limits we've discovered. There must be more to it. Remember how Jaspers himself moved in his own life from psychiatry to philosophy. It was just because the experiences he was encountering demanded reframing reality, not just reframing our minds, our psychological makeup. Now, this isn't fantasizing like Williamson the poet, because it's not denying the reality we find. That is there. But it is finding something in experience which demands we expand reality, go beneath, behind it, find something more. And that's exactly what Jaspers does, to fully account for these experiences of guiltless guilt and continually pressing ideals. He begins to imagine that reality must include dimensions beyond these structures of space and time and tragedy. Only that would account for this persistent moral light of idealism which refuses to settle with compromise. Only this gives meaning to ideals, even when they cannot be fulfilled. Now, I'm not concerned to press Jaspers' philosophy on you here tonight. Not in itself. His appeal to transcendence here is pretty abstract, pretty undefined, perhaps unpersuasive. It's certainly not, in itself, a traditional appeal to God or the idea of God. It's not a theological appeal. But I really think it's worth noting how that analysis he gave of the dilemma we're dealing with has set up that pressure to think in that direction of something transcendent. And so, yes, does provide a real pressure to think theologically and religiously and spiritually. And so it is to this now I finally turn, quite unapologetically, to a theological perspective on the dilemma. Because theology, at best, and it's not often at its best, I know, can and does give some shape to this very underdefined sense of transcendence that Jaspers is reaching after. Not, I hasten to add, because theology can give clear conceptual content to the beyond. The idea of God remains almost as shrouded in conceptual mystery as Jaspers' idea of the transcendent. But theology can and does give some narrative content to the idea of God. That is to say, if we understand this further dimension beyond tragedy as something to do with a personal God, we can find a concrete, purposive story which can then be told about God, and one which can actually be traced within history, as well as transcending it. A story which general philosophical ideas of a transcendent good or a transcendent ideal cannot really match. They cannot have that concreteness. So allow me finally just to remind you of that story, what it is. In a form set by this particular context we're dealing with, the context of this dilemma. It's a story which, of course, begins, as any cosmological story of the universe does, with an event of creation. But what it then tells is how this limited, finite world of time, change, contingency, and complexity, the way things undoubtedly are, the way this was not just created as a product of randomness or brute fact, nor is it all that is there. Instead, the story tells us it's been intentionally brought into being like this by a transcendent personal mind and will for a purpose. A purpose then unfolded in history, especially through the subsequent narratives of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And that's where we see how this world, made in this way, structured in this way, is actually a theatre for generating kinds of meaning which can only be generated by being set within these kinds of limits of finitude, time, and change. It's a meaning which only emerges when we try to act well within these sorts of limits, by straining against them to realize as much as we can of the ideal, even though we cannot realize it all, pressing onwards to the upward call, as St. Paul puts it. Because it's precisely in the interplay of trying to realize conflicting ideals within limits imposed by the world that some of the richest moral and spiritual meanings of life emerge. Think of experiences of sacrificial love, of purposive, cooperative endeavor, of compassion, of faith, of humility, of courage. In one way and another, they all emerge through that interplay of straining against these limits. The story also tells how God offers us help in this theater, not just by pressing the ideals on us through our conscience, but also by actively drawing us towards them with his active spiritual presence, what we call grace, not coercively, which would override our freedom, not making progress happen inevitably in every event. Life is palpably not all progress, but nonetheless working creatively with us to bring some good meaning of the kind I've just mentioned from our efforts, even when they're compromised. That's what we call providence. And all this, most luminous, of course, in the very particular historical story of Christ, where we see to a unique degree a pull towards an ideal, how it is lived out through a compromising set of political and natural realities which did thwart him, badly thwarted him. Yet from that thwarting, how it generated a meaning of sacrificial love, which is still inspiring the world. It's also in that pivotal story, especially in its mysterious narratives of the ascension, resurrection, that we see most clearly how there really is a transcendent source for these ideals, a place where they will be fulfilled, exactly that place beyond tragedy that Jaspers was looking for, that place which we sense calling to us through our residual dissatisfaction when we cannot achieve our ideals. That's the place we call eternity. The point of setting the dilemma in that sort of overall story, that overall worldview, is simply this, that it both more fully accounts for the dilemma, makes sense of the persistence of thwarted ideals, and it helps reframe the dilemma more positively. Because by describing idealism as the mind and will of God, it confirms the value of idealism, as nothing else can. Yet also by describing compromise as the task of reaching as far as we can within those limits to stretch our moral and spiritual fiber to create these meanings, that gives moral value to the compromise as well. In other words, it describes the world as one in which both our ideals and our compromises are equally tools of moral and spiritual meaning. It's a metaphysics of the world, if you like, in which thwarted ideals now seem more a gift than a curse. And so a world in which we need never sink into cynicism when they are thwarted. Which brings me very briefly to that very last question. What then is the metaphysic of our souls, which will match this metaphysic of the world? What sort of persons might we be in order to operate best in this kind of theatre? It's a question I mostly am going to leave to the final lecture, but let me trail just this now. In this sort of worldview, we certainly cannot and will not be the sort of people who always get things absolutely right in the sense of always being able to act consistently with absolute moral principles to produce ideal outcomes. Obviously, there will be contradictions when we try to implement our ideals in that way, as Williams and Isaiah Berlin in their different ways acknowledged, and for all the reasons Jasper analysed. But, and it's here I return to Hauerwas and his efforts nonetheless to hold conflicting ideals together, perhaps all that attempt at absoluteness is not the point. For what we can do and be within this sort of world is at least to try and hold all our ideals together in our character, in our deepest dispositions. That is to say, we can, with God's grace, try to be people whose deepest disposition is always maintained for peace, justice, honesty, even when these principles sometimes have to conflict in particular actions in practice. These can all be held in our core dispositions, even when thwarted or conflicting in practice, because the ideals really do exist, not just in our character, but beyond as well. They exist in God and eternity, and they can therefore always draw us on, always shape and motivate our action in some way. Do any such people exist in real life, in public life? People of such disposition and character? Cynics may doubt it. It wasn't doubted by Dag Hammarskjöld, the second Secretary General of the UN. In my view, an extraordinary exemplar, and I shall return to him in both subsequent lectures. He saw that kind of disposition in other people, working in practice, in public life, and he lived it himself. He was someone who kept pressing for a just peace through some of the most intractable international issues in the Cold War period, in the Middle East, in Europe, in Central Africa, Gaza, Suez, Russia, Congo. How chillingly history keeps circling round the same names, even as I say them. And by all accounts, Hammarskjöld kept pressing on through massive setbacks and personal vilification, not least because he had a disposition sustained by this wider worldview of faith, which enabled him to remain both realistic and unwaveringly idealistic. I quote from Hammarskjöld himself: "History often seems to run its course beyond the reach of any man or nation, and we cannot mould the world as masters of a material thing, but we can still influence the world when we see it as a thing of the spirit, or as I put it, as a theatre of the spirit." So that's what I've tried to do. Suggest a world view as a theatre of the spirit, which undergirds a way of being in the world both realistically and idealistically. Not presented as a trump card, as though the poets, the psychologists, the philosophers, the politicians have all produced their modus vivendi just to be outgunned by the theologian at the end. Honestly, it's not like that. Each digs at different levels and helps feed the other, but offered nonetheless as a view justifiably to sustain us in the experience of compromised idealism. Because I suspect, although some, perhaps many here, are blessed with the sort of robust temperament which does just get on with life without agonizing over its compromises, which perhaps doesn't feel the need of any metaphysics of either the world or the soul to help, I also know that for many in public life, the drip of compromise can seem corrosive, troubling, and it seems to me we need some help to live with it positively. Thank you.
intellectually stimulated, spiritually alerted? Who's going to break the spirit and tell us what question or comment? I don't think it's necessarily confining you to a question. I'd love to hear some observations from you so that Vernon can respond to them. Yes, please. Would you mind standing up? And actually gives you a chance to warm yourself if you stand up as well.
All right, and I get a microphone as well. Thank you very much for your talk. Most interesting. My name's Giles. I'm a gardener, and in my spare time I work at the Home Office. I was wondering if you could comment maybe on two things. Firstly, the picture you paint of the clash of idealisms is a maybe majoritarily negative one. And I was wondering if you could talk a little more on how they can collide positively, as you suggested, I think, of, you know, with hubris and resigning yourself. Maybe speak a little more on that. I think, secondly, you didn't talk on the origins of ideals, and I was hoping if you could say a little more on that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just on the last point, the origins, as far as I'm concerned, ultimately are the mind and will of God. That is, as I said at the end, that is really ultimately where they are, where they come from. There's a whole history that can be unfolded of how that mind and will of God becomes embodied in our own minds in ideals, some of which passes through the traditional religions and some which seems to come to our minds quite apart from them. So I in no way want to suggest that only the religious have ideals, nor do I want to suggest that only the religious have good ideals from God. But the ultimate origin of all good ideals are the mind and will of a God who has, in creating this whole structure of life, offered, if you like, a purpose towards which we can move. Now, the first part of your comment, thank you, how a more positive take on the frustration, really, or of these inevitable compromises and conflicts. Thank you. I mean, in straining against those limits, as I was suggesting towards the end, I did briefly mention the word humility as one of the fruits, and you're absolutely right. Probably should have said more. It is one of the dangers of the fantasizing reaction that I began with, is precisely that it tends to bypass humility and hardens into a mindset which thinks it can achieve anything. And in the end, it has to skew reality to make something happen. And that is when it gets really a dangerous sort of fanaticism. So the virtue of humility, which is something we learn precisely from realizing the depth of the impossibility, at least within this life, is a very vital one. And thank you for bringing it out to the surface.
Thank you. Yes, next, please. Thank you.
I think I win by dint of having the microphone. The world as theatre of the spirit. Are we players? Are we audience? Or are we perhaps groundlings who are called into action to be a bit of a chorus from time to time while others are doing sort of the major bits?
Thank you.
Thank you. That's a wonderful image and a very good one to try and unpack. We are players, but not the sole players. We're often the chorus as well. Let me just suggest an interesting analogy here, which was suggested by someone who watched, is it Peter Brook in action, the National Theatre director, or was it RSC, who likened a play he likened the world, to a play in which sometimes the director and producer actually came on stage with the actors and took a part, as well as clearly having an overview and an oversight of the whole thing. And moreover, in his own directing, he experimented with improvisation so that you didn't actually have to follow a set script. And this was the moment where quite a lot of his productions came to life, precisely when you don't give a set script to follow. So, by analogy, if we think of the spiritual presence of God with us, acting with us, a co-actor, drawing us on, drawing us in different directions, not actually giving us an exact script to follow, allowing us to improvise, this is when some of the deepest, if you like, interactions between characters happen and the greatest meaning emerges from the whole production. So my short answer, that's a long one, is we are certainly players and actors, but we're not the only ones, and that's critical.
Yes. Yes, a lady here, please.
Thank you. You did hint at the beginning that you would like to return to the ethics of good and bad compromise. Will you return now?
Thank you.
It's a very fair question. A good analogy, which won't cover every situation, but let me begin with it, is that compromises are a little bit like bacteria in the body. Apparently, we're full of bacteria, most of which are good, and work to benefit the functioning and the balancing of different needs of the body. But of course, there are bad bacteria, which are pathological and cause disease, really bad bacteria. And the compromises, I guess, are a bit like this. One of the, if I go to the easy end of it, the spectrum of the really bad compromise, one way in which this has been defined, the really bad compromise, is when you find yourself dealing with, acknowledging, or giving any sort of credence in the decision that is made or the action taken to what Hannah Arendt described as radical evil. And there's a difference between, as she defines it and as others have defined it, radical evil and the sorts of evil that all men and women do and find themselves bound up with. Radical evil is not a particular shade of grey within any one action. It doesn't simply relate to getting your own way or being selfish. Radical evil is an action in which morality itself is undermined, not just a particular way of acting in a particular situation. In other words, when the whole concept and notion of there being anything good or evil about the outcome is completely sidelined, it has become irrelevant, it is amoral. If we find ourselves involved in a decision or an action which issues in a radical evil, the setting aside of all moral considerations, then we are in the realm of radical evil and we're in trouble. Now, that may or may not, in the brief time at the end of a lecture, be a platform to think further, but I found it helpful.
Yes. Yes, please.
Barack Obama is fond of quoting Reinhold Niebuhr on how because we have high ideals, we somehow think that we're not sinful. And we allow these high ideals to delude us. And a good example would be, some people would say, the Iraq War. George H.W. Bush thought that he was liberating Iraq, ending a cruel despotism. But there are all kinds of other motives mixed up in that, and the results were not entirely as expected. Can't idealism sometimes be dangerous?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
It most certainly can, and particularly when it becomes a fantasy and truth gets skewed to fit the ideal you think you want to serve, which almost certainly did happen in the Iraq War that you mention. So I'm quite sure that ideals are potentially dangerous. I think one could almost say that ideals are exactly like compromises. They're like bacteria. You know, there's good and bad. In that sense. And when they're bad, they're very bad, and they're pathological. But the point at which ideals become dangerous is when they're allowed to skew reality. So we don't actually see what is going on. We invent what's going on to fit the ideal. That, it seems to me, is the best kind of criterion to apply. Of Niebuhr himself, he was very influential on Obama and many other, particularly American statesmen of previous generations. Interestingly, this is not quite your question, but it's a very interesting person to raise. He had this influence because he was generally reckoned to be a realist, a very thoroughgoing realist, mostly, I have to say, about human nature, which is, of course, that whole area of failing to arrive at the right or the best outcome simply because of our own natural weakness of the will or selfishness or whatever, or someone else's. Mostly he was deemed to be a realist because he took that very seriously, as it seems to me any human being should take it seriously, and certainly any Christian should take it seriously, the reality of human sin, to put it simply. But also because he too, though to a lesser extent than Jaspers, saw that realism is required by the very nature of reality. And this is what I was concentrating on tonight, because it seems to me, I may be wrong, this may be fond illusion, that we take as read that we're all pretty sinful. But what we haven't always taken on board is some of the sheer impossibilities which produce this guiltless guilt in people and which need to be put in a wider context. So that's why I spent more time on that than Niebuhr's kind of realism about human nature.
May I have one more question, please? That's put you off. Any more questions? Yes, there's a lady here. Thank you.
Vernon, thank you. I wondered if you might say a few words about the structure of reality. You mentioned, or I picked up, your phrases like different values coexist in character but not in action. We've got limited reach in terms of time and space, and also that complexity of reality is revealed by actions. But I wonder what other pearls of wisdom you picked up.
Right.
Could you translate the question, please?
Yes, thank you. I'm being pressed very fairly to say a little bit more about why, when we start acting, we discover just how inevitable some of the limits are of our reach. I think that was the question, isn't it? The normal, until recently anyway, our natural limits have been largely set, in fact, by the very fact of our finite physical bodies. Although we've always had minds and we can go beyond the reach of our bodies, in fact, you know, our minds are embodied. They're part of us. They have their limits too. We're actually, interestingly, entering an era where our limits are being, the boundaries are being pushed further out, obviously. I'm thinking now of artificial intelligence and the communications revolution in many ways. So, in fact, our limits that we meet when we are acting are constantly being pushed out. But in the end, these are limits in principle, not in practice. We will always come up against some limits. We may be able to achieve more than some other generations in certain areas, in the first instance because of technology, and now perhaps because of artificial intelligence. But by definition, the finite can never reach the whole. We are one part of something. We are not the whole. And therefore, when we try to affect the whole, we shall always find some limit in principle. I didn't want to be pessimistic. I think we can do more. And in some respects, some generations will do more. Though interestingly, some things and some people, I suspect we shall only reach, not because of greater technological expertise, nor because of artificial intelligence, but some people we shall only reach, in a metaphorical sense, if we begin to relearn the things of the Spirit. as well. So it's not just in the future that there may be more reach. We may have to look back to find the reach which we've lost, but it'll always be limited.